Arratsaldeon, bai.
Nik ez dut zerrentzik nahi du. Ez dut zerrentzik. Opa,
Koldo, arratsaldeon, entzuten nauzue? Bai? Bai, bai. Bueno, arratsaldeon. Eskerrik asko etorri zareten guztioi. 2024ko literatun jaialdia azaroaren 11tik 24ra bitartean ospatuko da. Eta gaurkoa urtean zehar egiten diren topaketetakoa da. Gaurko topaketa opari bada. Maxin Osipofekin elkartzea opari bada. Bere literatura irakurtzea opari bada. Eta gaur aurkezera natorrena idazle handi bada. Ordubeteren bueltan arituko gara solasean, eta ondoren tarte izango da zuek ere galderak egiteko, hausnarketak partekatzeko, berarengana hurbiltzeko. Gainera hor sarreran ikusi duzen modura, ontza liburu dendak salgai izango ditu bere azken liburuak, 101 kilometro, kilometro 101 liburua, eta bera ere sinatzen eta arituko da ala nahi duenaren zat. Arratxaldeon guztioi, Maxin, arratxaldeon. Maxin Oksipov, babesleku bat da. Bizitzaren gordina zizelkatzen daki. Murmurio txikika garrasien oihartzuna lehertzen du. Maxin Osipovek oso ondo asmatzen du esandakoa pausatzen. Azal mindu egin zaitzake, edo bihotza birrindu diezazuke. Baina isiltasunaren zalapartari gabe egoten laguntzen dizu. Maxin Oksipov babesleku bat da. Eta beheko zuaren epeltasuna oparitzen dizu bere hitz irudietan. Maxin, Donostia, San Sebastian, liburu aurkezpena, irakurleekin enkontrua, zer modu zaude? Gustatzen zaizkizu horrelako kontuak?
Well, thank you very much. It is my greatest pleasure and honor to be here. It's my first time in San Sebastian, and of course I enjoy the city a lot. Of course I like events. I like to meet people, and I write about people, and I'm curious about people, and so of course it's a great honor and pleasure for me.
Sendagilea zara, kardiologoa, Ukrainiako gerra hasi eta bi urtera nola dago Maximen bihotza?
Oh, well, it's a very big question. Well, it's not a medical issue, of course. It's somewhat else. Of course, there are major losses that I had. I lost I cannot visit my home, something that I built myself in Tarusa, and I cannot practice medicine any longer. I cannot visit graves of my parents. So losses are obvious, but there are also gains, certain gains. I, for example, started this teaching Russian literature to in Leiden University to Dutch students in English, something that I would never imagine I would ever do, and I enjoy this very much. Also, I started a literary magazine. I will show you the how it looks. It's in Russian, but it's Russian, I would say anti-war, but it's literary magazine. I just brought one volume of it with me. So it is in Russian and it is published quarterly. The name of this magazine is The Fifth Wave. Well, for every Russian, this name is very obvious because it's the fifth wave of Russian immigration, starting from revolution, where it was the first wave, then the second wave was during the Second World War, with people who were taken to Germany from Russia and who remained in the West. The third wave was mainly Jewish and dissidents in the 70s, and the fourth wave was in the beginning of 90s, when USSR collapsed, and the present wave is the fifth one. And of course, the closest attachment of the closest relation of this wave is the first one, because these are people who actually didn't want to immigrate, never thought of immigration. But you know, when this war began, we realized we have to go. So I would say I have mixed feelings about that, but I'm very grateful to the Netherlands, first of all, and to Europe in general for hosting us, me and my family. The rest of the family lives in Germany, and so we are doing well in given circumstances. So.
Bihotzarekin idazten duzu? Literaturak badu irakurleen bihotzetara iristeko indarra?
Well, it's a metaphor, right? So it's if I were urologist or you know pediatrician, what metaphor would you use? Cardiology gives a very easy way to, you know, of course, but I look at it in less romantic way, I would say. And these two things, writing and treating people, they are so different that I would not overestimate the role of medicine. If I were, say, chemist or you know physicist, I would have another set of metaphors, maybe. But in general, you know, I don't think that being a doctor affected my writing very deeply. I'm writing very often on the material of, you know, medicine, but it's not only medicine, it's also theater or politics and religion, religious life, even chess, classical music, you know, many other topics. But this is only material that I use. I'm writing about, you know, human beings, about people, and that's what I'm doing.
2007an hasi zinen argitaratzen. Betidanik idatzi izan duzu? Idazketak ze leku izan du hasiera haietan, idazten hasi zinenean, eta gaur egun ze leku du idazketak? Zer da eskaintzen diozuna idazketari?
Well, I tend to think that the process of feeling oneself, you know, myself in this case, a writer precedes the actual process of writing. So I felt that I should become a writer and that I am a writer before I wrote anything. And like many important things in, you know, in human lives, this happened almost, you know, seemingly accidentally. So for many years I kept some notes for myself, a sort of a diary, which, you know, became bigger and bigger. And just one day it happened that a friend of mine a very close friend and teacher and patient of mine at the same time, who was a Russian Orthodox priest, Father Ilya Shmain. He was ethnically Jewish, but he became Orthodox priest when he was around 40 years old. So he died, and I brought pieces of my diary to his widow and asking her just to support her. And it was a big document. It was like 45 pages or something, A4 format. And she, I asked her not to show it to everyone. It was very personal. But she sent it to the magazine, even, you know, in Paris. There was a Russian magazine in Paris. And they asked me to cut this text to make it, you know, 50%, to make it, you know, 50% smaller. And then I started working with it, and I sent them the abridged version of my diary, of the fragments of the diary dedicated to my friend. And then they said that, you know, Paul, the Pope, Johann Paul II died, and they need to put some, you know, article or articles about the Pope in their magazine. And so I have to cut it like by another 70%. And I dared to say that, okay, send me the text about the Pope. I'd rather cut this, not my text. And they say, and it was kind of bad joke, like saying at the you know, at the customs, at the border, that you carry a bomb in your suitcase, you know, something, some joke that you are not supposed to say. And so they cut it themselves, and they really, I didn't like the way this text appeared, and I took the full version of my text and gave it to the biggest Russian literary magazine. And they asked me to write something about, they published it, the full version, to my greatest surprise. And they asked me to write an essay about myself. And they published it first, because nobody knew me. And so this essay is published in this book. It calls In My Native Land, something like that. You can translate it this way. So that's how it all began.
Oso ondo idazten duzu, gertutasun izugarriz kontatzen dituzu inguruan gertatzen direnak, eta agian horregatik, inguruko pertsonek ez dute haietaz idatz dezazun nahi izaten. Ez dute zure ipuinetako protagonista edo pertsonaia izan nahi izaten. Zergatik gertatzen da hori? Kontatu iguzu zer gertatu zen Herberetako Holandako etxe jabearekin?
The owner of my Dutch house, of my, I'm sorry. Well, of course, people do not want to be protagonists, and none of us want to be protagonist in any stories. And but of course, it's a very difficult task to be, you know, a microbe and microbiologist and microscope at the same time. But I try to, of course, change circumstances and, of course, names, etc. And I try not to hurt anyone. So when I write about people in Tarusa, in this small provincial town, I'm pretty sure that probably none of them read my stories. They don't have a custom of reading stories. They are so-called simple people, you know, common people, who do not read much. But as for dealing with, you know, people who may read what I wrote, well, it's every writer knows how how difficult it is. I very often ask permission to use the story, to use some details, and usually I get this permission. So every writer knows how hard this task is.
Gaztelaniaz, El grito de la ave doméstica, piedra, papel, tijera, eta gaur mintzagai izango dugun kilometro 101 ipuin bildumak argitaratu dituzu. Zuri irakurria naiz, ipuinak irakurtzeko arreta handia jarri behar duela irakurleak, bestela galtzeko arriskua izaten duela. Denbora eta arreta zalapartaka bizi dugun garaiotan, norentzat idazten du Maximek? Zer jasotzen duzu irakurleen gandik? Zer esaten dizute zure idatzien inguruan?
Well, I think that only, you know, so-called mass literature is written for readers, in having in mind a particular group of readers. When I or many other writers write their stories, it is, of course, it's not for ourselves, but it's for kind of imaginary reader. You know, I write something that I myself would like to read. And of course, I do not think about any particular reader. There is a group of course, you know, friends, you know, not all of them are writers, but, you know, whom I respect as good readers. And of course, I show it to them first before sending it to, you know, to the publisher. Of course, you know, short stories, it's the genre that I prefer. Is for slow reading, and short stories are closer in many ways to poems than to novels, to poetry, or even you can compare it with musical sonatas, because when we listen to, you know, some serious music for the first time, it is not actually to appreciate the music, but to decide whether it's worth listening it again. Same with poems, right? So when we hear the line, then, you know, something touches us. We decide to learn this poem by heart, to read and reread it. Same with the short stories, and it requires much more work from the reader than novels, because with novels you can miss something, some pages even, but you will get, you know, the idea what this or that character is, you know, about the personality of the characters, etc. In short story, if you miss, you know, two lines, even few words, very often you are lost, because, you know, small details are important. And of course, for me, it's important not to show, you know, my characters in, you know, some of them are in extreme situations, but most of them are just, you know, living normal life. And so it's more interesting to show how a bad person is having lunch, I don't know, and give some small details, or looking at himself in the mirror, or, you know, doing just small things, than to leave the reader free, because it's up to reader to decide to sympathize or unsympathize to certain character. And so I try to make it the way even, you know, negative characters would say reasonable things. So that's probably how I look at it.
Eta nola idazten du Maximek? Nolakoa da zure idazteko prozesua? Nolakoa da zure ipuinen formatua? Nola definituko zenituzke zure ipuiak?
Well, there are two separate questions. The way of writing is that when I write, I write. It can happen elsewhere. I don't have like other maybe more professional writers who get up early in the morning or late in the morning, sit and write every day. I don't write every day. So it's more like, you know, boosts. It's more like, and when I start writing, normally the story is 30, 50, I don't know, percent ready within my head. Within some short replica, some short notes that I make, and each story has its own story, I would say. Some stories start with a name, for example. I just for many years I planned to write a story called Children of Jankoi. In Russian it sounds very nicely. It's Дети Джанкоя, so it's the Дети Джанкоя. And I thought, well, it could be even, what is Джанкой? In fact, it's a city in Crimea. And I heard this combination of words, you know, long, long ago. And then I thought maybe it would be a name of a dog or name of a horse, Джанкой, because it could be. And then, you know, it is in this book, that's why I recall this story. Sometimes it starts with the end of the story, so I know how it would end, and then, so it's, each story is individual, really.
Kilometro 101, 2024an, argia ikusi duen azken lana, 2006 eta 2022 urteen artean idatzetako zenbait ipuin biltzen ditu liburuak. Nola egiten da lako ipuin bilduma baterako ipuien hautaketa? Geldituko dira ipui batzuk bilduma hartatik kanpo? Ze gertatzen da kanpoan gelditzen diren ipui horiekin?
Well, it is very much up to the publisher. So this book, for example, in English, the book with the same title, Kilometer 101, it is much bigger. It's twice bigger, maybe. So it's Kilometer 101 in English, published by the New York Review of Books. So it's up to publishers to decide which stories to include. My publisher, Luis Solana, he asked me for this book to select doctoral stories. And he wanted a small book. And so all stories, there are mostly non-fictional stories. There are three fictional stories in this book. And the rest of the stories are, you know, non-fiction. So it was his choice, actually, and so we made it together, the selection. And of course, each country has its own traditions, like Germans prefer bigger books, French prefer small books, and different publishers have different views on that. So it's not up to me to decide which story to be included or not. So I trust publishers a lot, especially in the languages that I do not know, obviously. So that's how it goes.
Moskut Moskuti gutxi gora bera 100 kilometrora dago, N hiri txikia, Tarusa, eguneroko ohikotasuna bizi duen tokia, eta han idazten dituzu ipuiak. Zuk idatzia da, eta ze polita. Por suerte, el contenido de nuestra vida provinciana es completamente distinto. Muchos momentos únicos, emotivos. Te diriges por la mañana al trabajo, justo empieza a amanecer, y adelantas a un niño pequeñito, pequeñito, con una cartera enorme que avanza en dirección a la escuela, como el flip-flop de Lev Tolstói, un personaje que no le encontrarás, perdona, un personaje que no te encontrarás en ninguna otra parte. Nolakoa da ene iria, nolakoa da Tarusa.
Well, Tarusa has a very special meaning, a very special role in the history of my family, and I dare to say in the cultural history of Russia. It is a small town, but there were many, many very famous people who lived there, like Marina Tsvetaeva, one of the greatest poets of the 20th century. It was before the revolution, she had dacha there. And Postovsky, I don't know which names are known here, but these are, I mean, big names. Zabolotsky, one of the best Russian poets. Svetoslav Richter, a pianist, had his dacha there. Many, many others. And partially it happened because of its location. There were many painters, famous painters, who lived there as well. It is very beautiful. I mean, the nature is beautiful, but it is not only that. It is the whole concept of Kilometer 101 is that people who were released from Gulag in Soviet Union, they were not allowed to live in big cities at all. So they called it like minus 30, means minus 30 big cities like Moscow, Leningrad, Kiev, Tbilisi, Kishinev, I don't know, Novosibirsk, you name it. So they would not allow them to live there. And it happened not only at Stalin time, but it ended up, you know, with perestroika when they banned this barbaric law. So my great-grandfather, who was a medical doctor too, he in 1932, he was accused, falsely of course, accused like many, many others in Stalin time, of attempting to murder Maxim Gorky, a famous writer, and his son. So there was a plot, so-called doctoral plot, and they accused 14 doctors for this attempt. And he was sent to Gulag, to the place called Belomorkanal, which is, he survived it because he was a doctor and he treated people there. And he worked as a doctor at this concentration camp. And after that, he was not allowed to live in Moscow. So he, in 1946, he moved to Tarusa, and Tarusa was like these days you can get there as fast as, you know, hour and a half from Moscow. But by then it took like 12 hours to get there. You needed a train, even a ship. There were no bridge, so it was a big, big journey. And so many intelligent people knew about Tarusa, and they formed sort of a, you know, small social group that was attractive to others. And so many people came to Tarusa, and then that's how it started in my life, because I was born in 1963, and I spent several years, my early childhood there. And so, you know, then there is a long story. But you will find some of it in this book.
Detaile asko bai liburu irakurtzen duenak bertan topatuko dituenak. Maxim, eta nolakoa da Mosku? Zure hitzetan espazioa falta duen hiria da. Zein da Tarusa eta Mosku bien arteko 1 kilometroko distantzia horren neurria, dimentsioa? Kontatu diguzu pixka bat.
Well, Moscow is, I was born in Moscow, and I went to school in Moscow, I went to medical school in Moscow, and, well, most of my life went in Moscow. But, in, you know, very, maybe 20, 25 years ago, I really felt this city belongs to, you know, it's like occupied city for me. It's like it belongs to the enemy. It became, it is not my city any longer. These days in Amsterdam, I live in the house that was a very tiny house in the very center of Amsterdam that was built in 1670, so in the 17th century. You cannot imagine anyone living in the house of 17th century in Russia, because each generation of Russians has its own catastrophe. So my great-grandfather had a huge catastrophe with Gulag, etc. My grandmother had a big catastrophe. My father had a, you know, several major catastrophes, and so now it's my turn to have a catastrophe, and I would not pass my home to my children because they would live in Germany, most likely, and my grandchildren. So the cultural traditions they just, you know, end at each generation tries to do something, and then it, you know, abruptly is finished. So that's how it is. Very unfortunate. Plus the very unfortunate Russian tradition to solve problems with violence. You know, for centuries, problems in Russia were solved by violence. We have very few non-violent rulers. I would say Alexander II, who was killed in 1881, Gorbachev, who definitely tried to solve problems. He didn't want to use violence. But you cannot name other rulers of Russia. And what happens these days, of course, it's a result of certain, you know, very bad, ill will of one person, but it's not, unfortunately, you may say it is somehow follows this very tragic path and dreadful path of events in Russian history.
Eriotzari beldurra, bizitzari maitasun urria, jende arruntari, eguneroko bizipenei zuzendutako begirada hitzetara emana. Finean, zer da Maximeke ipuñotan kontatu nahi duena? Zure ipuñei ze kolore dutela esango zenuke?
Well, it's of course many of them are sad, but I hope that there is a humor there as well. So it's not that I'm telling something. If I have something to tell, I would write much bigger volumes. You know, like Leo Tolstoy or Solzhenitsyn. You know, there were certain writers who had an idea, and you know, some of them falsely, some of them really had this idea that they need to teach people something. I have nothing to teach. It's a way of thinking for me. Writing is a is the best way. You know, when I write, I figure out what I actually think. Very often there are questions that remain unanswered in my stories, or there are questions, the characters get answers to the questions they didn't ask. They ask totally different questions. So it's like this.
Denboran salto handia dago azken bi ipuinetara. Azken aurreko ipuina COVID testu inguruan idatzia dago. Azken Ukrainiako gerra hasi eta berehala hasitako bidaia baten kronika da. Bi kontakizun hauek zerbaitegatik daude hor, ezta? Besteen ondoan, hor behartzuten. Editoreak ala erabaki du.
Well, chronologically, they are close. So we experienced, well, although this COVID times for us especially seem to be very, very far away. In fact, COVID ended when, you know, 2021, so not so, you know, long ago. And the war began in 22. So in fact, they were close. When we left Russia, there was an obligatory thing to get, you know, for your airplane, get a test, negative test for COVID. So it was, you know, close. So chronologically, it's close. Emotionally, of course, it's totally different, because when we had COVID, there was a feeling that human beings finally can, you know, somehow unify against, you know, common enemy, you know, this virus, and work on vaccines and best treatment, etc., and best solutions. But then this dreadful war began. And it was obvious that this is definitely not the case. So that how it happens in our lives. And I think, you know, it was a good decision to put these two stories together.
Bai, denboraren saltoa nioen hasierako ipuietatik azken bi hauetara. Hasierako ipuiak 2006, 2007, 2010 urteetan idatziak dira, eta azken hauek ondo zenion bezala 2021 eta 2022an. Hor, tarteko salto horretaz ari nintzen. Bueno, hotza, lotxa eta askapena. Bidaia, Errusia, Armenia eta Alemania. Orain Herberetan bizi zara. La idea de vivir como seres humanos no les ha parecido atractiva. Hori diozuzuk. Wow. Olako egoera batean?
I'm waiting for the translation.
Zein da irten bidea?
Aha, okay.
The idea of living as human beings did not appeal to them.
I'm sorry, I missed the question. So,
zuk bidaiari heldu diozu. Errusia, Armenia, Alemania, alako egoera batean, zein da soluzioa? Zein da irten bidea? Gizakiak ere erakargarritzat hartzen ez diren egoera batean, zer egin dezake batek?
Situations where the human beings are not very attractive, what can we do in this
Well, of course, it's a very special, you know, feeling be a part of, you know, of a country. I left the country, but of course, I still keep a Russian passport. I am not a refugee. It's another status. I keep Russian passport, and I have permission to live, residence permit in the Netherlands, and I hope I will get a Dutch passport sooner or later, better sooner, of course. And of course, it's the question for all of us Russians of our individual guilt and of whether things like collective guilt exists or not. And you know, everyone, what is there were a lot of speculations about the role of Russian culture and its role of the imperialistic nation of Russian culture. Now, these kind of talks that I dislike very much, and we can talk about it separately. But of course, everyone is has to give his own answers, and there is no us. You know, it's everyone is represents himself these days and gives his own answers to these questions. I myself preferred I had such a mixture of feelings before leaving Russia. It was, of course, fear, it was anger, and it was disgust. Most of all, very strong disgust, and I felt like, okay, I spent 27 years of my life, first 27 years during socialism. Now they offer me to spend nobody knows how long during totalitarianism or fascism, whatever you call it. So I just didn't want to. But there are some very nice people, friends, who stay in Russia because they cannot leave. They may have elderly parents, or you know, they do not have means to stay abroad because it's very expensive. First of all, to the immigration is an expensive thing, or they may have you know, some obligations that they feel they cannot break with, and I respect that as well. So it's all very individual.
Idatzi duzu liburuan, separarse de los amigos resulta doloroso. Pero no de Moscú. Elkarrizketaren batean ere irakurri dut. Umetatik pentsatu izan duzula Errusiatik ies egitea, alde egitea, joatea.
Well, this is true. It's I have this Svianta. Svianta is there in this I believe the book starts with it. With the essay Svianta. It's about it's not childhood, it was when I was young. Svianta, no, Svianta is not there. I'm sorry, no, it will be in the next book. So, it is, Svianta is the name of the Lithuanian lake, and where I spent time with my parents. And I said to my Lithuanian translator, I remember very well, that surprisingly, it happened in 2017 when I visited Lithuania soon after my mother died. I decided to, you know, to go there because it was important place for us. And I said that surprisingly, my you know, feelings about and my thoughts are occupied with the same things that 35 years ago. First, not to get dirty. Second, I mean, in morally and politically. Second, not to find myself in prison, not to be imprisoned. And the third, not to miss the time when it is time to leave Russia for good. So that, and that happened, you know. So of course, this kind of thoughts were always present at the background. Because many friends immigrated long ago, and my daughter went to Germany. Well, she didn't feel like she was immigrating, but for professional reasons, she's a musician, she's a very fine violinist, she plays in the string quartet, and she got married, and they play together with her husband in this Elliott Quartet. And it happened in 2014, so obviously I was, you know, I was thinking, and I visited her very often of relocating. So it was always present at the background. So it was probably, that's why the decision that I made right after this war began was relatively easy for me. So breaking with the country, it's something like breaking with a wife or with husband, you know, for a woman. It should be just some, you know, final episode, and then you say, that's enough. So that was, of course, but the episode, I mean, the war was a very big shock, very big blow to all of us. And interestingly, Spain played a certain role in this decision, because when this the war began, at the first day of the war, we went to the center of Tarusa for a small demonstration, very small. There were like 7 people or something. Well, it's a small town, and it was dark, so we were staying there in the very center with banners, small banners, and I put on my banner, Cain, where is your brother Abel? Because the rhetoric was that Ukrainians are our brothers, whatever. So police didn't prefer not to notice us at all, because some of them were our patients, so they really didn't know what to do. And then for a few days we were just watching news on TV Rain. There is a Russian independent television that on the internet, of course, on YouTube, that they closed after that in a few days. And then on the 5th day of war, Luis, this Spanish, my Spanish publisher, called me and said, why don't you write something for us, describing what is going on. And I sat and wrote very quickly a very short essay, and I called it The 5th Day of War. And while writing, I realized something. As I told you, you know, writing is a best process to evaluate what you actually think. And then on the 6th day, I bought tickets to Yerevan. Yeah, so that how it happened.
Zenbat min tartean, hau guztia kontatzeak, idazteak, partekatzeak, arindu egiten du idazlearen eta irakurlearen mina? Ze kontu gogorrak kontatzen dituzun, baina irakurritakoak bildu eta besarkatu egiten du irakurlea. Emozio kontra esankorrak eraginez, benetan berezia da lortzen duzuna. Eta zorionak horregatik. Arintzen du idazlearen eta irakurlearen mina?
Well, it is, I'm not a scholar of my own writing, you know, I just write it, and whatever feelings readers may have, it's really up to them, it's their part of work. And sometimes I get very reactions that surprise me. I remember I was in Saragossa, and there was a lady after my first book was published, and there was a lady who spoke very poor English, came to me after one of those meetings and said, "Thank you very much, this story," and she named it, allowed me to improve, very much improve my relations with my mother. And I was really surprised because I couldn't see anything that could improve her relations with her mother. But of course I don't know her, I don't know her mother. So the way, you know, your word reflects depends on the reader much more than on what I actually am saying. Plus, of course, you know, it's all translations, so what do I know?
Kontatzeko oso oso modu ederra daukazu. Eta ipuinak bukatzeko oso modu goxoa. Ni Maxim zure ipuinen bukaeran geratuko nintzateke bertan goxo. Adibidez, honetan. Hace frío. Sales a la niebla y al cabo de 10 minutos entras corriendo en tu despacho. Metes la clavija en el enchufe. Todo resuena. Te pones la bata, miras las tinieblas que alguien ha pintado tras la ventana y te dices, 1. La cosa no mejorará. 2. La felicidad es esto. Zorionak egiten duzun lanagatik.
Well, I was satisfied with this.
Eta eskerrik asko.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Oraintxe Herbeeretan, zertan ari da, Maxim? Zer duzu buruan? Zer duzu bihotzean?
Well, it's a lot on my mind, but I don't write much. I almost do not write, and that really makes me sad, because I understand too little, and you need to pick up small details. Of course, in the Netherlands, everyone speaks English, and most people speak very fluent English, so there is no problem in understanding on the everyday level, or even, you know, to argue about politics or Dostoevsky or whoever. But to pick up, you know, really small details, you need to live longer in the settings, and you know, because for me it's I'll tell you an episode, and you would understand, you know, what I mean. Me and my son-in-law, we went to the restaurant to pick up the order, and it was in Frankfurt. And my son-in-law, he speaks very good German. He lives since 2008. And I, you know, I tend to say that he speaks like Franz Beckenbauer, you know, the famous footballer. And so, not like Goethe or Schiller, of course, but, you know. So we went to pick up this order, and there was a man near the restaurant who was not homeless, but who definitely spends a lot of time outside, in the streets. And he was with a very ugly dog while we were waiting for, you know, for our orders, with a very ugly black dog. And all of a sudden he turned to this dog and said, Adolf, come, you know, let's go. And I asked, and he laughed, you know, he laughed, looked at us, laughed, and he said that, you know, he want us to react somehow. And then I asked my son-in-law, what was it? Is he a fascist? Because, you know, the name Adolf is forbidden in Germany. Not for dogs, probably, I don't know. So is he anti-fascist? Is he a joker? Is it that, you know, since I look like a Jew, I'm ethnically Jewish, so maybe he wanted to offend me. Should I start fighting with him? I mean, I don't understand what is going on. And my son-in-law said, me neither. I mean, I don't understand, I don't know. And when I told that to our German friends, they said, well, you missed something important. I mean, there is something we would tell, and I would tell if it happens in Russia, from very small, you know, things, you know, details of the clothes, I don't know, the accent, of intonation, you know, this kind of things. But I'm missing it, living abroad. That's the thing. And that really scares me and makes me unhappy. So maybe I am able to write about misunderstanding, lack of understanding. So that would be another point of angle of view. Let's see.
Ideia interesgarria da. Liburu guztia irakurriko nizuke zuei gustura, baina hau behintzat irakurri nahi dizuet. Maximek idazten du Kilometro 101 liburuan. En San Petersburgo, en Moscú, o en provincias, eta nik gehituko nuke y en el mundo, la vida da pavor. O digámoslo así, también da pavor. En ella se dan cosas sobre las que es imposible escribir. La muerte de víctimas inocentes, incluidos jóvenes y niños pequeños. La experiencia pavorosa y prescindible del duelo por su muerte siempre nos acompaña. Y no hay modo de gritarla, de expulsarla a gritos. Y luego llegará el día y de nuevo aparecerán los pajarillos, las aves del cielo, domésticas, silvestres, de todo tipo. Y el mundo no se rompe, pase lo que pase. Así está hecho el mundo. Eta Maxim, ez da diez mundua puskatu, baina utz diezaiola bizitzak izua eragiteari. Garraxe egin behar badugu, garraxe egingo dugu, txori kantu hotxen erritmoan. Eta zuk segi idazten, segi ezinezkoak ere idazten. Eskerrik asko.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thanks.
Bakarren batek.
Now we have
galderaren batei nahiko balio, hausnarketaren bat partekatu nahiko balu.
Arratsaldeon eskerrik asko. Nik galdetu nahi nioke, gaztetan zuk bazenekien egunen batean joan egingo zinela Errusiatik. Orain barruak zer esaten dizu, Maxim Osipov itzuliko da Errusiara, eta barruak zer esaten dizu, egongo da gerrarik Europan? Batzuk aipatzen ari diren bezala, prestatu behar dugula gerrarako.
Well, there are many questions in this one question, right? So I didn't know I need to leave. It was the idea that it might be needed. I didn't want to leave. I was really opposed to this idea for many years. And when USSR collapsed, I was very patriotic for a few years, I would say, and I really dreamed of building a new Russia, a new country. And for the first time in my life, I was proud that I can be part of it, whatever. But then, of course, Russia took another path, and slowly but steadily, it became more and more different from what I wanted it to look like. So about war in Europe, I am pretty sure that it depends on the outcome of the present war. Putin will, he needs war, and he will keep, you know, this war situation as long as he is in power. So most likely as long as he is alive. So who would be the next, if he wins, if he conquers Ukraine, the next object, the next victim could be Moldova, it could be Kazakhstan, but it could also be, and most likely to be, Lithuania, because he's, you know, he Baltic states, and his dream, of course, is to crack down NATO, because some countries would say, you know, we are not going to fight for Baltic states, we don't want our boys to die for, you know, Lithuania, whatever. So it is possible. Yeah, everything is possible. So I'm not a political analyst, but that's how I feel about that. As for coming back to Russia, of course I would love to visit. But these days it's impossible for at least two reasons. First of all, it is not safe for me, of course, after, you know, all these publications and this magazine, etc., etc. And secondly, even if it were safe, I would say psychologically it's impossible. I cannot imagine going back to Tarusa for what, for a week, for a month, you know, coming to the hospital saying, hello, here I am, you know, they would say, hello, so what? And so that would be a strange feeling of visiting your own home as a guest. You know. So this is impossible at present moment. But when and if political prisoners are free and the regime would be different, I would, of course, like to visit. I don't think I will come back and live there, because the next regime would be very, very criminal, I'm certain. There are, in Russia, unfortunately, I read Babel, Isaac Babel, with my students. And if you read Isaac Babel, there are main characters in his stories are either Cheka, you know, so secret police, and criminals. And criminals are very charming, very attractive in his stories. In reality, they are not charming at all. But these are two main forces we have. I'm not saying that there are no nice people. There are a lot of nice and kind and intelligent people still in Russia. But they do not represent any force. By representing force, I mean, like, you know, in Poland in the 80s, they had Solidarity, and they had Catholic Church, which was very strong, and it was a force, really a force. Look at Russian Orthodox Church, I mean, official church these days. It's, I mean, what it looks like. It doesn't mean we don't have nice and brave priests. We do have them. Few, maybe more than we think, but they do not represent any force. That's the thing. And of course, then nowadays, all power in Russia belongs to secret police. Whatever you call it. So the next regime would be criminal. So it would take decades or even more before Russia has a chance to become a free, peace-loving country, which I really wanted to be, of course. Any other questions, please?
Gracias, buenas tardes. En este contexto que nos está mostrando un tanto pesimista, ¿cree que sigue el destino trágico de Rusia, como muchos de nosotros, de los amantes de la cultura rusa, como yo me considero? ¿Y no hay ninguna alternativa a ese tipo de tragedia que viven los rusos desde hace tantos siglos? Y por otra parte, ¿qué espera usted de los europeos en tanto que posibles actores o incluso víctimas de la política agresiva de Putin?
Well, again, I am not a political analyst, but of course, you know, I'm happy that Europe supports Ukraine in various ways. Of course, I want Europe to become stronger, probably to spend more on its defense, bigger part of its, you know, gross income, and of course I am scared of this right populists that you know, won election even in Netherlands, although they got Wilders, he got only 23%. And he will probably not form the coalition, whatever. But he's a right populist for sure. But people like Orban, people like Marie Le Pen, who has big chances to win, and who are all Putin supporters. So people like Trump in the United States. Well, people like Trump. Trump is unique. You know. So. thanks God. And of course, there are something about supporting those Russians professionals who would like to leave Russia and who get very little support, and it's very difficult for them to do that. In fact, I don't think this politics is reasonable, because if you know, the engineer would leave Russia and gets, we are not talking about stipends, grants or whatever, just, you know, give them ways to work and to, for example, my son still after 2 years, he doesn't have a bank account. It's very difficult for Russian to open bank account. Now, you cannot live without a bank account, right? So if me, or he's a doctor too, so, and he will hopefully, he passed German exams and everything. So he's now looking for a job. So as soon as he gets a job, then finally they would open him an account. But of course, I'm talking about this kind of things. I'm not talking of support that you give to, and thank you very much, to Ukrainian refugees. I'm talking about professional. If you take engineers out of Russia, then Putin would have less weapons, probably. So this kind of things, plus sanctions do not work, you know, at all, almost. It's you know, a joke. You can get almost everything in Russia. There is no. You know, there is no change of everyday life, and that really helps Putin, of course, to continue his politics. Because the major difference between pure fascism and what we call Putinism is that Russia, the nation, is still immobilized. He tried to tell people, okay, you live your everyday life, nothing has changed, and many people see around them that, you know, it's a normal life, why bothering? So that's hope I answered some of your questions. There is a gentleman there.
Sí, por la fecha de nacimiento creo que ha tenido usted que conocer muy bien la figura de Alexander Solzhenitsyn, que fue premio Nobel, pues no sé si en el 70, no me acuerdo ahora muy bien. Y o sea, me gustaría saber en qué concepto le tiene en el día actual, en el momento actual, una figura tan emblemática, tan virtuosa, tan excelente persona, que en esta parte del mundo pues le perdimos un poco la pista en el final de su vida, cuando él renunció a Occidente, fundamentalmente. Y también me gustaría saber, ya por último, me gustaría saber qué opinión tendría en la actualidad de la situación esta de agresión a un pueblo hermano, ¿no? como el de Ucrania. Y si tendría tal vez algún gesto de solidaridad con Alexei Navalny, la situación que se ha vivido en torno a esa otra figura emergente, ¿no? Y que también es un concentrado de virtudes.
Well, again, it could be a subject of, you know, two separate lectures. well, in brief, Solzhenitsyn, of course, I admired his early works, like One Day of Ivan Denisovich. I think it's a masterpiece. And Archipelago Gulag is also, you know, it's a fantastic piece of work. But I don't like many of his writings, that many, you know, things that he wrote afterwards. And Solzhenitsyn's last years were, unfortunately, he supported Putin a lot, and his ideology, he was, you know, Russian nationalist. He wrote this anti-Semitic book, 200 Years Together, pretended to be objective, but in fact it was anti-Semitic. And his ideas, some of his ideas, Putin put into his doctrine, into his modern doctrine. So this is a very contradictory person as we see him now. And so this is about Solzhenitsyn, very, very briefly. As for Alexei Navalny, of course I admire him. I met him personally, and it was a very, you know, big grief and a shock for me to learn that he was killed, and he was definitely killed. Now we know it almost for sure. We don't know details, but we'll know them, we'll learn them, and you can read what I think about Navalny into. I wrote an essay the next day after his funeral, called Black and White Russia, and it is published by El País in Spanish. Well, it was published in Russia, I mean in Russian language abroad, and also in several other languages, but in Spanish you can read it in El País. So yeah, I admire this man. He's a real hero, and this is kind of heroism that you cannot fake. You cannot really, you know, it's like to be genius. It's like to be saint. You know, you cannot fake it. And another thing, well, we have number of heroes, but what was special about Navalny, that he was full of joy. You know, this joy is also a very special gift, I would say. You know, when you see a joyful person, despite all circumstances, you know, it really make him very, very special. Any other questions?
Vesteri.
Quiero decir que todos lo admiramos, sabíamos qué podía pasar, pero ¿por qué volvió a Rusia sabiendo que era muy probable que corriera esa suerte? No llego a entenderlo. Puede ser, sí, que su figura pudiera crear un levantamiento popular contra Putin, pero era muy, muy poco probable, ¿no?
Well, there could be a sort of, you know, religious answer to that. Why did Christ let him to be crucified? I mean, this is the idea of sacrifice. This is one thing. Another thing, I think, you know, if you saw his conversation on YouTube with with this chemist, with his murderer from FSB, or the telephone conversation he had just before he left Germany, it is fantastic. I mean, if you haven't seen it, it's you know, artistically in all ways. I mean, this is the best movie I you know. Documentary I ever saw, and he, you know, people tend to believe in their star, so-called. You know, the question is whether these star exist or not. But when it was a miracle that he was saved. It was a miracle that he became, you know, he was healed. He didn't become crippled after all he experienced, and he believed maybe of this chain of miracles that would happen, and plus he was a politician. For Russian politician, he thought it would be, the best place would be Russia. So, of course, So we don't know. He took this risk. He took this risk, and he was killed. And he's a hero. It's difficult to and impossible, you know, to put ourselves in the shoes of a hero, right?
Bueno, iruditzen bazaizu hementxe utziko dugu. Maxim, eskerrik asko. Gogoratu hor sarreran liburuak salgai izango dituzuela eta bera sinatzen arituko dela hala nahi duenarentzat. Gracias, eskerrik asko eta laizter arte.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.